Hey guys, this is Andrew from Things I Want to Know. If you like the podcast, please leave a 5-star rating. Don't really know why this is important, but it is, so let's get the voice out. Also, don't forget to check out the podcast Paul G's Corner, a podcast where everyone gets a voice.
Afghanistan, 7,500 miles away from Arkansas. Afghanistan has been conquered and reconquered over the millennia only to return to its natural state. Religion, orthodoxy, and corruption run wild. These people live there every day, commuting to work in sometimes big cities, and sometimes by foot. Are their lives that much different? Can they call themselves a different type of human being? Or are they just like us? Do they live their life just like we do, with the same complications? Richard Walton is a world traveler and has been there many times and negotiated with the good, the bad, and the ugly to help people who need it. Richard, how are you doing today?
Great.
Excellent. Tell us a little bit about your trek here, your Afghanistan living stuff.
Do you want me to start how I got there or where I lived in over there? Okay, well, it all goes back to 2008. It was a big recession here in the United States. For some of your listeners, I might remember that.
The housing crisis.
Yes, and my business was architectural design. Had my own company for 30 years. Had about 10 people working for me off and on. And I always tell people that it's a recession when your neighbor's out of work and it's a depression when you're out of work.
So this is this is still kind of the height of the Afghan war with the United States.
Yes, it was.
Even though Bush celebrated many, many times how many times we've finished it, we didn't actually finish it because it kept coming back.
Right. And one of the first things I learned when I would get over there, I had some people tell me this is the graveyard of empires. So just like you did in your opening talking about Afghanistan, that's the way it was. But to make a quick story about how I got over there, the recession came along. I had to lay people off. Several of my contractors I worked with went bankrupt. The ones that could afford to and were of that age retired. And so I was trying to just scramble, just trying to make ends meet. My wife was a stay-at-home mom with three boys. And so, I tried to pick up work here and there, and I'd even call other architecture firms, and they'd say, hey, Rich, we just laid off 300 people.
Yeah.
It was just horrible. So I started just sending resumes out, feelers all out. I remember one time I even went down and applied at the brand new Costco store out here in Oregon, and they had 4,000 people apply for 72 openings.
Wow.
And so, it just got pretty ugly real fast. And
kind of
so,
the opposite of the way it is right now. You have a job opening and no one applies.
Right, exactly. And so we started putting out some feelers, and through some coincidences, we had a couple of people that my wife knew through the U.S. Naval Academy where one of my sons was going, and they mentioned that they had some work overseas. And so to make a long story short, after trying to get all these shots and everything all on my own, because I'm a civilian, I'm not a military type person.
Yeah, you had to get vaccines and stuff, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And every disease you can possibly think of is in Afghanistan. Smallpox, leprosy, TB, rabies are really bad. Everything.
Tomfoolery is also an illness that I've run into.
And I did do a short about a month in Iraq, but people would tell me, well, if Iraq's a third world country, Afghanistan is a fifth world. Not to put it down, and not their fault. It's just because of the centuries of war, education hasn't been a real large priority for the rural people.
So would
there.
You say that education is what's held a lot of these folks back in Afghanistan?
Definitely. Definitely. And you can see even like in our school systems here in the last several years of what people are taught and shouldn't be taught. You know, if you can't read the Quran, which is their, you know, their religious book over there,
yeah,
then you're at the mercy of whatever people are telling you it says.
That's true. Well, that's what Martin Luther, that's what he was against when he left the Catholic Church in the 1500s. And he said everybody should be able to read the Bible. And the
right.
Catholic Church said, no way, that's heresy. And they tried to kill him for it. But,
right.
You know, it's, everybody needs to read it or else it's, you get stupid stuff like having penance on the steps where you whip yourself right. and then give the priest $50. You know, that's probably – do they do stuff like that there?
Yes.
Wow.
but that is – you know, it's just to non-believers. But what finally – take you a little bit about my history. I was in college during the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And I had a deferment, so I didn't have to go. My friends were coming back and saying, hey, Rich, this might not be a place where you might want to go. And so I was having a good time in college. So I said, okay, and just kind of let it go at that. And then time I got out of college, the war was over, so I didn't do anything. So I'm the only male in our family that has never served in the military. And so
your son is in the military too now, right?
All three of my sons. Yeah. I have two sons. One just got out of the Navy. He was a Navy flight officer. He flew in the P-3s and then
nice.
I have one still in the Army. And then one that's was my oldest one was in the Coast Guard. So old dad, never been in it, been a civilian, just sitting on, resting on my laurels over here, working hard, trying to create a business that all of a sudden just, you know, went away.
No brigadier generals then.
No. So with $300 in my pocket, Paul, I got on a plane with a one-way ticket to Baghdad. That's
oh,
where
wow.
I had to make my first stop. And I had no idea what I was doing. Got to Atlanta, Georgia, called my wife, said, is this something I really want to be doing? Because I was going over by myself.
Yeah.
I didn't have anybody I was going with. And and she goes, well, if you don't like it, you can come back. And I thought, boy, that's pretty insensitive. So people are dying over there, you know.
Hey, if you don't like it, don't worry about it. Just come on home.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. You know, just make sure you duck. And, you know, if there's, you hear the sirens, you know, go in the bomb shelter. You'll be fine.
That's right. Right. Yeah. And I learned that real fast. That's what I had to do over there. I mean, I had no idea what I was going to be, where I was going to be on. I assumed I was going to be on a giant base because that's what I saw on TV, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And
sure
when I finally got to Afghanistan, I was in a house in the city with two Christian Lebanese bodyguards. And
what?
So that's
wow.
how my first deployment started over there. And I went over there twice. I went over there in 2010 for about 4.5 months, came home, tried to restart my business again. Stuff still didn't pick up. So then I had another opportunity to go back over there again. I thought for another year and ended up staying for 4 years.
Huh.
So why did you have bodyguards?
Well, because people wanted to kill me because I was an American.
Oh, yeah.
So living in a house in Afghanistan, we had to kind of be on the lowdown. So when I would get these different contracts we would bid on, that's what we were trying to do. I worked for a construction company that was trying to get government contracts over there. There's cell phones, but there's no street names. There's no 80% of the people can't read or write, no fault of their own. I love the people over there. But if you can imagine trying to navigate through all that type of stuff, where do I find out where the lumber is? Where do I find out where the
yeah.
cement is? Where do I find out where all this stuff is? Well, what you do is you hop in a car and you drive around. And
in Baghdad, that might be dangerous.
Yes, yes. And matter of fact, when I had to get my fingerprints done, when I went to the green zone, people heard about that. I lived in the red zone. I lived
yeah.
outside of that. But people said, I mean, you just get out and you drive around? And I go, yeah, that's what I do. And so
– did you have an armored car?
Sometimes you did and sometimes I didn't.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
So, running around in a Toyota 4Runner.
Yeah, when I first got to Iraq, I got separated from the kind of the people that I was on the plane with.
Oops.
And they pulled me aside and pulled me over to this room. And the guys are standing there with the guns and guards and everything. They took my passport and they said, visa no good. And I went, uh-oh. And they said, you sit here. And I thought, oh, and they took my passport away. And I thought, oh, I'm gone. Nobody knows where I'm at.
Yeah.
Nobody knows where I'm at. You know, I've seen this stuff on the news and the people and everything. Finally, they came back, and what they wanted was me to shake me down for $150 for a new visa. And
ah.
so then I gave them half of my $300 that I had. And then when I got out, there was a sign there that said, you know, Rich Walton, And so I went over there, and that was where I started my adventure. And the guy said, here, put this on. I go, what is it? And they said, well, it's a bulletproof vest, but it's not really bulletproof.
Yeah.
And so
bulletproof vests aren't bulletproof.
We jumped in a car, and they started driving down through Baghdad on all the roads, going the wrong way, the right way. Every time we come to a corner, a bunch of guys would jump out, hold their guns up, stop traffic, would swing around, go through. I thought, wow, this is just like in the movies.
All for one dude.
Yeah, so I was there for an orientation of about, I'd say a couple of weeks. And then from there, I flew over to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And that's where my real adventure started.
First day of orientation was duck and cover.
Yeah. Secondary orientation.
Here's how stop a leg wound from bleeding.
Don't die. Exactly. So, it was a whole new way of doing business when I got to Afghanistan. And you're basically, I was just left out, you know, with how do I do this? Who do I call? Where do I go? You know, there's no Delta phone book. There's no
Cell phone reception out there.
A little bit.
Maybe in town, but that's
about it. In town. And so the first time I was over there for the four and a half months, I was working for a contractor trying to acquire government jobs, working for the Army Corps of Engineers. We bid on those type of jobs.
You probably had a satellite phone, right?
No.
You didn't even have a satellite phone?
No, I just had a regular cell phone.
Oh, wow.
Paul, the you couldn't have planned out my life. The second or third day of my life, a warlord showed up my doorstep and told me basically that my company owed him $30,000 and bad things were going to happen if I didn't get him the money. And so when I got a call from my headquarters in Baghdad, they said, how's it going, Rich? I said, well, I think there's this guy that's going to burn down the house and kill everybody if we don't pay him. They said, okay, let's look into that.
You know,
I think it's more than let's look into that.
We have a board meeting in the morning, but you know, we'll go ahead and push this up. We won't let them. It's okay.
And what happened was the guy that had my position previously, which they never told me, took off with a bunch of money and never paid some of the loans. And so when I looked outside the door, as I walked the guy to the door, because I had an interpreter that lived with me in this house, and I looked outside in the street, and here were probably about 50 Afghans with, you know, they looked like Taliban. Who knows what they were?
Yeah.
All standing there with their AK-47s and all, you know, kind of his protectorate. And to make a long story short, you know, they gave me the money to pay him off back what they owed him, and we moved on from there. But
wow, yeah. So you know, what I've been told is that opium is the biggest money maker in Afghanistan.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it is like, for good or for worse, it is like one of the most pest resistant and disease resistant plants. You can grow it anywhere, in all kinds of climates, all kinds of elevations, everything. I could fast forward to a position where I was on a base one time, and I saw this brown or black sand we were putting in sandbags to protect our little base we had there, and it had sprinkles of gold color in it. And so when I took it back to the main city of Jalalabad, I had my interpreters have it assessed, and it was gold. And so everybody was all excited, thinking, oh, we'll go up there and we'll make all this gold. And I said, well, one, you'd never get in and out because you'd be killed. I said, and two, this isn't what they're concerned about. And they go, what do you mean? I said, here's their gold. And I'd show them pictures of hundreds of acres of poppies.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because it doesn't rot. It doesn't, you know, deteriorate. And when I would talk to the different farmers about it, I said, well, I thought we had a program where the United States was trying to teach you guys how to grow cotton. And they said, yeah, well, if we don't grow cotton, the Americans get mad. If we don't grow poppies and opium, we all get killed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you wrote a book about all this, correct?
Yes.
So,
yeah, and the name of the book is, One Brick at a Time.
One Brick at a Time. And I saw that it was available at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, it's available at Barnes & Noble on Amazon and then on my website. The only way I can sign the autograph copy is if you go to my website.
What's your website?
It's One Brick at a Time Press, press.com.
All one word, One Brick at a Time Press.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Absolutely.
But if you want to save some money, I'm not have to, you know, because I don't get any of it. So, you know, you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and they usually cover the postage.
Yeah. Well, you get some of it, don't you?
Yeah.
They didn't steal it from you, did they? It's possible. No. It's happened.
I guess, you know, who knows? I get a little step and check every once in a while, but you know, I don't think I've hit a break even part yet. I don't know. Maybe I have.
Yeah. It's book publishing is so much different than people think it is. So it's crazy. The fact that you have a distributorship into Barnes & Noble is that's more than a lot of folks can say, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that was a whole experience unto itself. I mean, there's times where I just want to throw my hands up in the air and just say, you know, forget it.
Did you do that yourself? You broke that one yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And so it was a matter of, hit and miss and frustration.
It's hard to deal with those corporations, man. It's as bad as distributing a movie. You have to get a distributor of a movie. You have to have an agent and then a manager and all blah, 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 blah. And then finally, once you've gotten the movie made, which takes like 17 different organizations to get it made, then you've got to find somebody to distribute it. And if they don't distribute it, the movie dies.
Yeah.
Same with books.
Oh, my gosh. Who has the money for a manager and an agent and all that other stuff?
It costs $50 million for a movie.
Yeah.
It's just so, stupid crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, that was basically what I did. It's got a lot of photographs in it.
Nice. Yeah, are they full color illustrations or are they?
No, it's black and white. I couldn't afford color.
Yeah. It's expensive. Yeah. So when you were – now, one of the things that you were doing was you were building places in Afghanistan, right?
Yes.
So
– yeah, and so – so when I came back the second time, that's really when I started getting into building. Now, this I put on a different hat. Before, I was working for an individual contractor trying to acquire the jobs, and we were always being undercut by Afghanistan contractors.
Sure.
So we never really acquired much any work at all over there. So then when I came home, I tried to get my business going again for about 6-9 months. Still, this is 2010. So 2011, I went back over. This time, I was working for a private contractor who was contracted out to the Air Force. And so what we did was he oversaw these Afghan projects. And so I would go out there and meet with the Afghan contractors, make sure they were doing stuff right or correct, try to help them along to how they do different things, try to find the ones that were, you know, blackballed last week and they changed the name of the company this week.
I saw you in here yesterday.
I had three contractors come to my little tent office one time with the same brochure. And the only difference was their name was taped on different on the front cover of the front of it. When I finally started laughing and presented the other two to the third guy, he goes, "Oh, Mr. Rich, those are all fake. Mine is the real one."
Yeah, good luck. At that point, who knows who the real one is?
Right, yeah.
Good grief.
Yeah. When I was – I had one businessman over there who was an Afghan contractor. He went to the university in Beirut. He was an engineer, and we became good friends. And he said, "Mr. Rich," he says, "I'm going to tell you something." He says, "Remember these four things. We will lie to you, cheat you, steal from you, and try to kill you." And he says, "You base all your decisions on those four things, and you should probably survive Afghanistan."
Oh, wow. My gosh.
And this, I'm just like, this was like about my first months in Afghanistan. I went, okay, this is not like doing business in America. And the other thing they'd always come to me when I was living in the house, backtracking a little bit, is every contractor would come in the office, an Afghan contractor, he goes, "Mr. Rich, do you have enough guns? Now we can get you more guns. Do you need more guns to protect yourself?"
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So the people there, though, it sounds like there's a lot of corruption going on.
There's a lot of corruption going on. I mean, people are just trying to survive. By the time I got there, and when I came back for my last stint from 2011 to 2015, they kind of figured it out that as the different people rotated, the different military forces rotated in every 6 to 9 months, you know, from the United States.
Yeah.
Time they would figure out what was going on, they went back home and a new group came back in. And so they thought, oh boy, you know, here's another person with another checkbook. We'll just raise the price and we'll raise the price and we'll raise the price and we'll raise the price. And so, you did have that going on there all the time with that. So One of my favorite sayings is called Inshallah. And that means God willing. And so for a long time, people would say, I'd say, are you going to get this concrete made by tomorrow? Are you going to get some bricks laid by tomorrow? And they go, oh, by Tuesday, Mr. Rich, Inshallah, which means in God's will. Well, a lot of stuff didn't get done. So it took me a year to finally figure that out. And I said, okay, Mr. Rich will pay you on Wednesday, Inshallah. And they go, Mr. Rich, you can't use Inshallah against us because you're a Christian. You're not a Muslim. I said, well, Mr. Rich is. So
maybe you'll get paid if you get it done on Wednesday.
Yeah. So, but once you know the rules and the games played and that type of thing, it takes you a while to figure it out. And I like people and I like meeting with people and I would go out and meet with people and work in the field with them. They were surprised in a lot of cases that there was even an American out there on the job site.
Wow. Really?
Because most engineers and architects never leave the big giant bases. I heard statistics over there. I don't know if it's true or not, but I heard statistics that 80% of the military forces don't go off base. So it's just the 20% of the infantry and recon and that type of stuff. And those are the guys that took me out. So when I went out for my last 4 years, I would have different military units that would take me out to my job sites. And when I had a first wake-up call was when I had all these 19 and 20-year-old Army people with me. I said, okay, guys, how long do I have out here? And the sergeant looked over and goes, because I just went by Mr. Rich. And he goes, Mr. Rich, we're out here as long as you need us. And at that point in time, I had a kind of a wake-up call going, wow, I'm responsible for putting all these people in harm's way, to look at my little school or my little building that I'm doing.
But you're building schools. Schools are important. And I think those guys, I think the majority of those guys, when they, they would probably say to themselves, look, they're building a school for these little kids to go to. I don't have a problem standing out here defending the construction as long as these little kids get to go to school.
Yeah, something good.
And the schools varied. I mean, when you're in a lot closer to the bigger cities of Kabul, Herat, and Kandahar, the schools were fairly large size. When I get out into the remote villages, it might be, 25 feet by 25 feet.
Yeah.
It's just a single room. Could be a concrete floor, could be dirt. One level bricks could be made in a kiln if we're close to a larger city, or we actually made them out in the sun, and we called those sun-dried bricks.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite testing programs is where I'd hold the brick straight out from me, and I'd drop it. And if it broke, I told them we had to use new bricks, and they would all get a big kick out of that. that was my quality control.
So what I want to know, what I'd like to know about this is the people. Are they obviously there's different, little things that they do different than we do as Americans, because as Americans we've always been brash and out there, and we're always generally outspoken.
A little spoiled.
I think that's the new generations are a little bit too spoiled. Gen Xers are a little bit rough and tumble. We really don't care anymore, which is Andrea and I. And I guess you would be the generation before the Gen X, but not quite a boomer. The boomers are a little older than you. So how would you say their culture is compared to what we do on a daily basis?
I would say you could break it down into different groups. You got the ones in the major cities, like Kabul. They got universities. That's the capital city. They have condos where musicians and different people like that live in. The warlords live in those nice condos and those type of things. So it would be very comparable to what we have here in the United States. So a lot of their buildings, or office buildings, are like one story with glass and those different types of things. And so, it was very similar. Now dirty, yes. The streets are, mostly dirt, and there's some few paved streets along
those
lines.
Even in Kabul?
Yes. Uh-huh. And then every once in a while you turn a corner and there's an old abandoned Russian tank, sitting there.
Yeah. Somebody's got to move it. I don't know. Just leave it there. It's not in the way.
Yeah. If you could start a scrap business, you'd become a multi-billionaire if you could get all that material out of there.
But you had to pay the warlords first.
Yeah, exactly. and those are some of the things that you would learn and deal with. And so once I was able to work around with those people. But say the average person, yeah, they go to work. When I lived in Kabul, I had a cook and a cleaning lady that showed up at my house every day. She had to wear one of those burqas, one of the blue things, so yeah. No one knew that she was coming to the house. And my cook came there, and they showed up every day, and we paid them, and then they went back. When I was out in the countryside, I would be out there, and the tradesmen and stuff would be showing up. And one of my favorite stories is I was here. I'm the smart American, right? I was humbled so many times, Paul, over there. It was just I enjoyed it. And so I'm telling this brick mason and all these guys building this wall around this base how they have to put mortar all the way around the brick and put them in place, and not just slap it down and stick it on top. So I figured, voila. I did my job. So I go back to my little tent, and the next day I come out with my interpreter, and they're back doing it the same way as they did before. And I thought, well, maybe we didn't explain it right, or maybe something like that. So I had my interpreter try to explain to them, what we did. And they just laughed, and they pointed up at the hill. And on top of the hill was one of Alexander the Great's castles. It was built in 300 BC, and it's still there. And so they said, we are doing it the same way that our ancestors built that, and that is still standing. And I started laughing, and I slapped the guy on the back, and we kind of hugged each other. And I just said, I stand corrected.
Keep trucking, brother.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Wow.
So, there's so many times like that. I would have these eye levels where I could go out and measure stuff, and they'd bring out their little water level, and we'd have a little contest to see, who came up with the most accuracy. And every time, dead on,
Because they're poor and ununiversitized, universityized, or whatever you want to call it, doesn't mean they're stupid. They're still
and they wanted to learn. And I can't begrudge them for that. I mean, I would just go out to this job site, and the guy that was the mason, the next day he was the plumber, and the next day he was the
electrician. Wow.
There's obviously no union or mob bosses out there.
There's no codes. And every once in a while, we'd get these government officials coming out, and they go, these stairs are uneven. And I said, well, what's it say on the drawing? Plus, they can't read the drawings because they can't read or write.
Yeah.
So they call them maps. So, I mean, things got to be a little different out here. And I said, on your drawing, what's it say there for the stairs? And they go, 7 to 9 inches. And I go, that's right. And they would make one stair step 7, and then make the next one 9, and then they make one 8. You didn't have anything on here that said make them equal.
Andrea and I need your help. If you like our episodes, please give us a 5-star rating and a review. Not sure exactly how that helps us, but it does, and it makes people want to listen. When they see that 5 stars and a good review from you, so go to wherever you're listening to your podcast, Apple, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartMedia, wherever, and hit that 5 stars.
Well, right? That's true. I mean, people take it pretty literal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of the common sense that we thought we've grown up with, you could just throw that out the window. I had my cleaning lady one day. I thought I was going to help her clean my house. I actually had a real toilet in the house in Kabul. So I brought her a cleaning brush, right? The kind you scrub out the toilet?
She probably thought that was crazy.
Yeah. And so I gave it to her, and she lived in a mud hut, no electricity, no running water, outside outhouse type of thing. And so I gave it to her and had my interpreter kind of explain how you do this. So I was getting sick all the time, but I knew that was because of, the food and different things like that. And one day I walked by the bathroom, and she was in there singing, la-da-da-da-da-da, and she had the little brush, and she's cleaning the toilet bowl, right?
Yeah.
Well, she assumed it was a universal tool. So without washing it or rinsing it out, she goes over to the mirror, and she starts cleaning the mirror, right?
Oh,
and
no.
Then she probably thought, I like Mr. Rich so much, I want to really do a thorough job. So she went over the cup that had my toothbrush, and I took my toothbrush, cleaned the cup, and then just to top it off, because you don't want to have any food particles left in the brush, my toothbrush, she took the brush and she cleans my toothbrush and then puts it back in the cup.
Nice.
Oh, if you can only see the look on my face right now, I'm totally horrified. But I mean, you don't know what you don't know.
Some of my guards and different people that I had there would get upset, and I'd say, hey, knock it off. She's doing what she's doing the best job she has.
She didn't know any better.
No, one other one I had, where I saw the guy, the cook, scrubbing the floor, and with a rag. And then I came in at lunchtime and he had it on top of the rice pot to keep the pot, you know, from rattling from the steam coming out and everything. And I knew all that dirt was going into my rice. So I explained to him, you know, only use a clean rag. Okay.
Yeah. This, okay, there's, you guys, you wouldn't have to, you needed to explain to her that she wouldn't have to work so hard to clean the toilet if she wouldn't use the brush on your toothbrush.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so the next day I'm eating this bowl of rice.
Well, am I wrong?
And so this rice, it tastes kind of funky. And I go, what is with this rice taste? It tastes like bleach. So I go back into the kitchen with my interpreter. Oh. It's a little tiny kitchen. And I go, what's going on here, Sophie, with this rag? And he goes, he holds up his thumb, you know, like, okay, Mr. Rich, clean rag. And I said, well, how is it clean? It's the one you use on the floor. And he goes, watch. And so he goes over and he takes over the sink and he pours bleach all over it, wrings it out, and then takes it over and puts it on top of the rice pot. So all the bleach was dripping into the rice.
It's clean.
Yeah, it's, I mean, clean. He doesn't really understand. I guess
your rice is extra white today.
Yes. So when the dish made me more endeared and made me realize that what seems logical to me is not necessarily logical to them. And
but they were probably both felt somewhat humiliated when they figured out when you explained to them what they had done.
I had a young interpreter. He's 21 years old, and I would always try to explain to him, you know, I don't want to be upset. I just want to tell him that this kind of stuff makes Mr. Rich sick because he's from a foreign land and he can't, you know, eat the same stuff that they do, you know, to a certain point, you know?
Yeah.
And throughout my whole travels, I would be out there where I'd be dropped off with helicopters. I traveled all around Afghanistan in helicopters.
Oh, that would be as dangerous as that is. That would be awesome to do.
It was, and it was. I had a backpack and a sleeping bag, and the one thing that made it especially easy for me was because being a civilian, I didn't have to have orders. And so I could hop on a helicopter and fly wherever I wanted to.
Yeah.
And, you know, just all military helicopters, mostly U.S., but sometimes Italian and other ones.
English,
I would just land in different areas. And I'll never forget this one time I was on this foreign remote base where you see all like the movies like Lone Survivor and all those type of things. I was up in that area.
Nice.
And so I landed on this base. I'm over there working on this Afghan little building over there with the workers, and I'm down on my hands and knees, and all of a sudden, da 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 da, here comes the Americans. And a colonel comes flying in with his helicopter, and there's Apache helicopters and Chinooks flying all overhead. The guy comes down, puts his little SAT screen thing or whatever it is on the ground, pointing up at the air for communications, and they come around the corner, and they look, and they go, who are you? And I go, I'm Mr. Rich. They go, Mr. Rich. I go, yeah, I'm the tip of the spear. If I don't build it, you don't live in it. And they just kind of looked at me and walked away, shaking their heads like, who is this guy?
He's out here we're chasing down warlords. And then there's just some dude out here with a pair set of plans going, hey, y'all, anybody want to help build this? I'll pay you.
Wow.
And
the hell he come from?
And then what I do is I take pictures of the different people, like the Afghan army people and everything like that, because they didn't have cameras or anything. Then when I go back to my main base, because I'd be on main bases and helicopter out of those things, they call it kind of a spoke wheel type thing. But I would bring pictures back to them, and they would just be so excited because they'd have pictures of me and them, and you know, they didn't have pictures of themselves.
Did the military ever like say, hey, yo, give us those pictures too?
No.
They should have, because you could have been standing next to, you know, Taliban's most wanted. And
could have been.
You know, he's just like, I need to eat too, man. I need 50 bucks.
Right.
And so I put in a week's worth to get my week's worth of work. I get my 50 bucks, and then I can go back to the front line and, you know, RPG a tank or something, you know. But he's still got to make money.
Well, and that's a lot of it that I found, that people would tell me the stories of, you know, young men and everything, because there was no work over there for a lot of people. And that was a job. So it wasn't a matter that they were fighting the jihad. They were just trying to put food on the table.
Some of them were,
you know, that type of thing. So, but when I would go out of these bases, a lot of these Afghan army guys, after a while, they were literally like around me, protecting me, because they, you know, I had one time when I had a bunch of people stand around me. He said, Mr. Rich, tell those Americans to get farther away from you, because when if they're standing by you, you make a better target.
Yep.
You know, because they can get, you know, a lot of us all at one time.
Yeah. And so they had mortars. I mean, my cousin Erica, she was in the green zone for a good year and a half, 2 years in Baghdad, and she said you couldn't go outside. If you went outside, there's always some dude somewhere with a pair of binoculars that no one's seen. And he says, oh, there's people out there. And he radios it to his buddy, and his buddy throws the mortars at you and tries to kill you.
Yeah. And a lot of times where I land with a helicopter, there's nobody there.
Yeah.
I mean, I jump off the helicopter, and literally, a lot of times I'm not on a base. And there goes the helicopter. Yeah. I go like, whoa, where's the base at?
Your SLO. You know,
and I had times where I'd be sitting for 4.5 hours along a riverbank waiting for a helicopter to come in, because you never know when it would come in or not come in to pick me up. And across the river, I'm thinking, okay, is there some guy across there deciding if they're going to shoot old Mr. Rich?
Yeah.
You know, because I'm just sitting there out in the wide open by myself.
Yeah. Well, it's probably a good thing you were sitting out in the wide open by yourself, because they knew that you weren't doing anything. And the word gets around, you know, they probably said, no, this dude builds stuff. He pays people. So let's not kill him, because he may pay us next week.
That's right.
You know, I mean, don't shoot that guy. He's got
money. And one of my favorite stories is the one time I got a call from the Afghan army, and they said, none of our air conditioners are work. They're called mini splits. They're these little things that kind of sit up on the wall, and they kind of have heat and electricity. So I fly out to the base, and I laugh. I started laughing. They go, what's so funny, Mr. Rich? I said, well, no kidding. You have your mini splits don't lift. They've all been stolen.
Oh, no.
So they said, when do we get new ones? You know, so that's some of the stuff you deal with. And so anything you lost or, you know, got stolen, you can buy it back in the bazaar, you know, next Friday, you know, if you wanted to.
Well, the people, though, did they seem, there's some corruption and stuff like that. I get that. But are they that much different than what Americans would do if you went to, say, you know, a poor place that had basically no rules?
I guess I would want to know, like, what are the family units like? Are they like
the family units? They're very family oriented. That's one of the things I learned over there was, you know, they have a hierarchy, of course, in the family with, you know, the sons and everything. But they're very family oriented. They protect their own. And you've seen in some of the movies where, like, Lone Survivor, where the village protects the one Navy SEAL and stuff. So if they become endeared to you, They do watch over and kind of protect you and give you a heads up. I had a couple times where I was told, don't go there right now. Okay. And and then if you walked in a village and there was nobody on the street, that's probably not a good idea to stay there, because, you know, something's going to happen.
Everybody knows it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had one time where I was supposed to go out to Bagram. That was kind of in the news, the big base. That was our biggest base. That was the Russians' biggest base over there. And then we took it over, but I had to drive out there, and off the top of my head, I just said, okay, let's go Wednesday. You know, I don't know. And so, Tuesday, a car bomb went off and killed everybody on the road.
Okay.
So then Wednesday we drive out and we see what's left of that. And then we come back. Thursday, the same thing happened again. So then my two Christian Lebanese bodyguards came up to me and started laughing. And they go, Mr. Rich, you picked a good day. And then at that point in time, you think like, wow, every decision I make could have an impact on somebody, whether they live or die or get hurt or not hurt. And so after that, it became a joke. Every time I was going to a really bad place, I'd go to my Lebanese guys, okay, how bad a place are we going to today? And they'd look over me and go, Mr. Rich, I think we're going to see Jesus today.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, well, I don't mind seeing Jesus, but I just should not be today. Okay.
Oh, so did you ever encounter any of the females in Afghanistan, or is that kind of like not kind of a taboo kind of thing? Like most of the females stay in their house or, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, now, here's the thing. When you're in the big cities and before the Taliban, obviously now it's back to the Taliban again, but before they came back and took everything over, in the cities, there would be, I built universities, dorm in Herat for girls, and you'd see them in the streets. Some would have the burqas on, you know, the old blue burqa covering their whole body, and some of the girls would just have a headscarf on. So it varied in the larger cities. Then it depended on whether you're going to like a Pashtun, really traditional village or something like that. Then the only girls you see out are like 8 years old and younger.
Yeah.
Playing with the kids. And I mean, they're all playing together. But the women would stay inside the home and can only leave the home if they're escorted by a male. You get up north to some of the areas up there where it's a different tribes. I remember it's all tribal there. I always used to tell people that, you know, Afghanistan isn't really a country. It's an association of tribes. And so you get up north and they're a little bit different up there where they don't really enforce the burqa requirements and those type of things. So you'll see the women and stuff out there working. And when I was doing schools and different things like that, they would show up. And then I got pictures in my book of the different women and stuff like that without being fully covered and clothed. So it just varied. Up in the northeast part, people say, well, Mr. Rich, how do you drive around, you know, looking at the way you do? And of course, you can see me on as I'm from a Swedish German descent. And so my hair is blonde and my eyes are blue. Well, up north, lo and behold, some of the remnants of Alexander the Great's warriors are still up there, army, and they have blue eyes and blonde hair. And so
cool.
I have uncanny pictures in my book of what standing next to the Nuristanis, and I look exactly like them. And so they would dress me up in their clothes and they'd have me meet with the elders and they say, Mr. Rich, just don't say anything. And so I sit there and I have the beard because I had to grow a beard. I never had a beard in my whole life. And they would say, okay, now speak. And I'd say, okay, something. And then they'd all shock and they go, Nuristani? And I go, no, not Nuristani. So, you know,
so the country directly north of Afghanistan is Turkmenistan or something like that?
There's several. There's Turkmenistan off the left. There's Uzbekistan. We got China over to the right.
And China. So you have some Mongolian influence.
Yes.
And then you're going to have, what's the?
Turks. Yeah,
you got the Turks, and then you got the Christians because they were all up in there. Because remember, they moved way back in the day. They moved the Pope to Turkey, so that was Christians.
They did drive me around and show me where the last Jewish person lived in Kabul. They said, "There's where the last Jewish person lived," and that's okay. He had a store or something there.
You got the heck out though, huh?
And then you have the Pashtun who are a little more. Dark hair, a little more olive colored skin. And some of them claim to be descendants of King Saul. So who knows, you know, you have to take everything kind of with a grain of salt. You got to kind of separate fact from fiction and myth from truth.
You got the Hmongs. Yeah. They're probably up there. Did you run across any Sikhs?
Yes. Yeah. Well, the Sikhs came over and worked on the bases, you know, so they would be on the U.S. bases and the different bases. The thing you got to keep in mind over there, which was a total eye-opener to me, was, you know, I knew there'd be the British and some NATO troops, but they had a coalition over there of over 50 countries.
Yeah.
And so I flew into a military base one time, and the border guards all around the base were from Mongolia.
And Chinese.
I go, what are you guys doing here? And they go, I thought you guys were friends with the Russians or the Chinese or something. I mean, I didn't know. I was American. And they go, some of them spoke English, and they go, well, yeah, we were with the Russians, and then the China gave us a better deal, and now America's building schools in Mongolia, so here we are.
Nice. So the Hmongs, we've got a large population of Hmong folks here in Northwest Arkansas, which I didn't know about until a few years ago. And there's a lot of Hmongs, which are Mongolian, Chinese, kind of, and they definitely look like not Chinese. They look Hmong. I mean,
but most of the situation in Afghanistan is most everybody is Sunni. It's not like Iraq and where Shia and Sunni. There is a group of people called the Hazaras over there that are the Shia, and they're kind of a minority, and they're looked down on and kind of like a subclass that everybody doesn't treat real well. But I had engineers and different interpreters that were actually Hazara, and they kind of look like the Mongolians. You know, type people.
So they do have a type family life, I suppose.
Yes,
that you're saying.
Yes.
And commerce doesn't, you know, we got big box stores, things like that, you know, go to Walmart, Costco, Sam's, mm-hmm. get a Safeway and buy your food, you know, crap like that. Go to, our bazaars are not really bazaar. It's just a bunch of, you know, farmers markets, whatever.
Yeah.
Might have had more bazaars out in Oregon than you would in Arkansas, but that doesn't matter. So the, I guess everybody has to go buy their food fresh. There's really no supermarket, is there?
No. I mean, you would get in this there again, in the big cities, you would have some stores and like Kabul and Herat and Kandahar. But once you got out into the other areas, it was all kind of markets, roadside stands, selling stuff. It was seasonal.
Does everybody have electricity out there?
No. No, and even in the capital city of Kabul, we would maybe have 4 hours electricity a day. So, hey, you know, look forward to California with the rolling blackouts. So we had a generator in our front yard that I had to switch on every few hours for that.
Yeah. So the question I got, I guess, is because everything is it's. I've always been the person that says, people say, well, let me back up a second. They say, for example, the Bible doesn't have any reference now because it was 2,000 years ago and things are different, right? Or, you know, things like that. They say the Constitution of the United States doesn't mean anything now because it was 200 years ago. It doesn't mean anything. Everything's different. But it's not. We're still human beings. We still deal with jealousy, hatred, love, lust, greed, and anger. It's the same emotions that we've been running off of since the beginning of time. So if I've always felt that if you just because the society doesn't have the amenities where we can run a podcast from my kitchen table, which is what I'm doing, it doesn't make any difference if we're still just the same as we were 2,000 years ago. So at this point, what I'm thinking is that the folks in Afghanistan are almost representative of what it was like 200 years ago.
Easily that or even farther back. I would say I'd always tell people when I went out in the far remote areas and saw the nomads and stuff out there still living in their tents and everything, it looked like, you know, I would see on the movies and different things of Lawrence of Arabia and those type of things. Yeah. And people said, you know, you just need to tell everybody that your name is Mr. Rich, okay, because a lot of people here don't have last names. And when I would talk to a lot of different interpreters and different people out in the villages and different things like that through my interpreters, they didn't know what day they were born on. They didn't know what year they were born in. They kind of had an idea, maybe, you know, kind of what, because it wasn't important to keep track of those type of things. And so one day I was sitting there laughing at myself and a couple of my bodyguards were saying, thought I'd been out in the heat too long and maybe I've kind of finally lost it. And I said, it is biblical times. And they go, why? And I said, because nobody in the Bible has a last name.
Yeah.
And they said, David didn't have a last name. Solomon didn't have a last name. Noah didn't have a last name. You know, Abraham didn't have a last name. And I said, so it is kind of like that. And so when I would go out there with a lot of these people, it was that way. I even had where I had a bodyguard. We called him Baba, means grandfather. And he came really endeared to me. And we tried to learn each other's language a little bit. He finally told my interpreter that if we were overran by the Taliban in this house I lived in, he was going to cut my head off and put it in a clean hole. Because he didn't want me to be tortured. Ow. And so I...
Okay. Okay. Thanks, so Grandpa. I appreciate it. Sure. I'm not...
Every once in a while, I'd be looking out into the yard. We had this yard. It was about 10 feet by 10 feet. And he had a little hand sickle, you know, cutting the grass. That was my lawnmower. And he'd put up to his throat and kind of make that cutting slike like that. And he'd laugh and giggle. And I'd say, make sure you tell Baba to wait till the last minute.
Yeah.
By the house and not jump over the wall. Okay.
He's just waiting, man. He was like, I never really had a good excuse.
I don't know if that's an endearing comment or if that should be a horrified comment. I mean,
I think both.
Yeah.
Both. So, okay, I got a question. You said something about they took you to the last, I guess, the last house the last Jew lived in.
Uh-huh.
I take it there's not a whole lot of Jews in Afghanistan?
None that anybody know? I mean, there might be some that some don't.
On, you know, maybe on a base or something like that, but yeah, not anymore since they run out the NATO. No. So.
Yeah, so the idea, they chased out all the Chinese out of the major cities. Now, of course, they're letting them back in. But at that time, they chased them all out. And like I said, the Jewish people, the Taliban, you know, pretty much let this one. I don't know the story. I think you can look it up on the internet. But he was there for a long time. He had a shop of some type, and I think he just passed away, and that was it. But yeah, so he was the last one there. So it's a different kind of system over there because everybody in the country is Muslim. So when I would talk to people out in the villages and different things, they thought, well, you know, the Christians are terrible because, you know, we got bad people just like everybody else. And so some of the contractors, some of the military, some of those people, well, in their mind, they're all Christians because everybody in America is Christian.
No.
You're like 30% identify as Christians.
Because everybody in Afghanistan is Muslims. You don't have a choice.
Yeah.
So you had to kind of get your head wrapped around that. When they'd explain that to me, I'd go, well, no, those guys probably, you know, I don't know, if it, not me to decide, but, you know, they might not be Christian. And they go, what do you mean? They're from America. And I go, yeah, but it doesn't work that way. You, in America, you get to decide what you want to be. It's not like here where you don't.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if it's like a overall the Taliban and other people in the country just have an extreme dislike for Jews, and that's why none of them live there, or just
and Christians too. I was told by two of my bodyguards one time when they found out my name was Richard, they said, don't ever you say that to anybody here that your name is Richard, because they'll want to kill you more than they would a Jewish person. And I went,
ouch.
And I go, wow. And I started thinking, and of course I had a lot of history and architecture and stuff. I go, you mean because of Richard the Lionheart in the Crusades? And they go, exactly. So they've carried that. They don't know why, you know, they don't understand all this stuff, but
just,
you know,
oral history. And they just
oral history. And because
grandpa said they're bad, so I say, okay, yeah, they're bad.
Yeah. So that was kind of an interesting comment.
Which
that,
grandpa,
you know, I got. Yeah. So
what? I'm making gestures at Andrea. She's like, shut up.
I'm like, oh, Paul.
She hasn't said that yet today.
Oh, my God, Paul.
Yeah, it's what she normally says. I usually have something that comes out of my head. It's like I told her last week, I'm the one that you have to worry about what I say, not you.
I'm just kind of curious because we always get kind of told in the news and in general, like the healthcare is over there awful. Women are treated like crap, you know, that, you know, they give birth in the middle of the street. I mean, you know, and I would like to think that that's not completely true, but.
I can't say that. I can say I never saw that happening in the street, but there again, you got two societies. Well, I call it two societies. You got the city society and you got the rural society. And in the city, they had hospitals. And I'm not saying that you'd want to maybe go to some of them, but they did have a French hospital there, a few things like that. So they do have some kind, you know, have different health care. That was the other thing. You know, where do you get your medicine?
Yeah.
And so me being an American, I'd have to go to a U.S. base to, you know, get my shots and get my medicine.
Well, if you needed morphine, you probably could. Yeah. You're in the right place.
But, you know, I couldn't get aspirin.
Yeah.
Because I had to have my wife fly over aspirin for me because that thins the blood. And if I get shot, I'd bleed out faster. So that was kind of banned. So you had to have Advil or Tylenol, but no aspirin. So I became kind of the pusher man because I get all this aspirin sent to me, and all these older guys that were taking aspirin to thin their blood for high blood pressure.
Yeah.
Say, I didn't get my supply from back in the States. Can I buy some off you and I'll replenish?
Dollar a pill. But these are baby aspirin. I don't, you know, you want it or not.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Andrea, to get back to your question, there are cases that the women are not treated very well at all. Okay. Like right now with the Taliban, there are no girl can be educated over the age of 8 years old.
I hate that.
And so I want to, and then there are cases where it's called Shawar law. It's S-W-A-R-A. Now that's different than Shia. Sharia. So that is where you give the daughter of your tribe or your person to another person to resolve the differences. So when I was living in this area in Kabul, a man killed his neighbor. And so to resolve the dispute, the man gave his 11 and 13-year-old daughters to the man of that other tribe to resolve the dispute, and that was the end of it, and everybody was fine with it.
Wow.
So women are currency.
Yes.
My only experience is I worked in Dallas, and I ran into all different types of cultures and nationalities and things like that, and I did take care of a Muslim woman. She was from Iraq. She was in the hospital. But anytime I would try to talk to her, because that's kind of what we're taught in healthcare, you talk to the patient, right. You advocate for the patient. She would never speak to me, and her husband would speak for her. And that was really strange for me. And I would go back to my charge nurse, and she'd say, she won't speak because her husband's in the room. He speaks for her. And I'm like, well, I'm asking her for pain medicine, and he's telling me she doesn't need it. I'm thinking, how in the hell does he know she's in pain? And she's like, you're just going to have to let it go. And it was really hard for me because I felt really bad for her.
Yeah.
So when he left briefly, I don't know where he went, and I would go back in there because I had to give her medication. I'd ask her, I said, do you want something for pain? And she says, my husband's not here. And I was like, I'm asking you. And she said, I can't. And I said, if you want it before he comes back, just hit the call button. But I had to wait until the husband came back for her to even take her medication.
Right.
So it was just really weird. I mean, we didn't have very many Iraq patients, but it totally blew my mind. I'm like, is this normal over there? I mean,
yeah, that's why I get sideways a lot of times with the rhetoric that people, they would, you Americans are so bad. We're misogynistic bastards and stuff like that. And it drives me absolutely insane because the people who are saying that are speaking at the side of their head. They have no idea at all how badly women are treated outside of America and how good that everybody has it. Now, I'm not saying that you should give up trying to have, you know, equal rights or equal whatever. I'm saying, you know, just step back for a moment and look at the reality of your situation. In America, you can do whatever you want. And yes, there's going to be men out there that are jerks, but there's also women out there that are jerks. And I've run into them, and Andrea's seen it happen. So it's, you know, it's the same for everybody. Just realize how good you got it, man. You know,
we had a veterinarian lady one time that went out on one of the missions with us, and there was a pregnant woman having some problems, and the husband had a cow, and she related the story to me when we were taking another helicopter out that she wanted to help look at the wife, and the man said, no, you need to look at my cow. And she goes, well, no, your wife really looks like she has some problems. I need to look at her. And he goes, no, you will not look at my wife until you look at my cow, because this is the only cow I have. I can always get another wife.
Wow.
Yeah. 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 I mean, but so, I hate that the Taliban won't let the little girls be educated. That was like the first thing I heard. But as soon as the airplanes left, the next news I heard out of Afghanistan was that they're now destroying, not some of the schools he built,
right,
were destroyed by the Taliban because they're built to house girls.
Right. And I don't know the schools that I built, if they're still there or been repurposed for other situations.
They were tearing
not.
Some of them down.
But, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They even would tear down the regular schools because they weren't teaching, radical beliefs that they had.
Why?
So
what is wrong with that? Blows my mind, man. But
yeah, go ahead.
Other than that, though, I mean, are the men more aggressive? Or are the men just men? We're all just friends, you know. I mean. How does it compare to how we do things? And it just,
well, it depends. People. One, it depends on the tribe. Everything's tribal over there. So it's a lot different than any place else because of the tribes. And so that varies. You know, you have the Pashtun are always fighting against the Taijaks and different. And you have two major languages. You have a lot of other languages, but the two major languages are Pashtun and Dari. And so now you got this language difference that creates a lot of issues. And so Dari was the language of the government and the northern tribes. And Pashtun was the language of the kings and the, the major tribe in Afghanistan, which is the Pashtuns. So to even make that more complicated, when they divided between Afghanistan, the British did, and at that time was India, then became Pakistan, they cut the Pashtun tribal area right in half.
Wow.
So sound familiar, kind of like what the British did, you know, in Iraq and all those other places.
Yeah.
They didn't care, and they just put a line and said, this is where it's going to be, and that type of thing.
We do owe a lot of the world turmoil to the British.
Yeah. Yeah.
With them walking around and just, it's like if you go to India, parts of India are very, you know, their culture is intact, but there's a lot of India where you're like, wait, you just did something English. Why did you do that? And that's the strangest thing possible.
Well, they were a colony, though. I mean,
yeah, I know. And a lot of those guys have British accents. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, get back to your question, Paul, about the men. Yeah, it just depends on their education, who, you know, what tribe they're from. I got along with all of them really well. I guess they can see the sincerity where I'd get down on my hands and knees and I'd get my hands dirty and I would work with them. And they knew that I was taking a chance. I mean, you know, if I was out there by myself working with them, or if I had a few guards or something around me, you know, watching over me, you know, I had the opportunity to where there was places where the U.S. government didn't, armies didn't go, because certain parts of Afghanistan were controlled by different nations. And so I got to travel with the Italians. I got to travel with the Romanians were awesome. Those guys would just go anywhere, do anything. And I used to always kid them about riding in their vehicles with them. I'd say, now, do I have to worry about any of you guys being from Transylvania and getting bit?
He's like, but stupid American.
Stupid American, you know? And so they'd all laugh and giggle about that, and then kind of make, you know, a little thing like they were going to bite me type of thing. You know? And so,
that's funny.
But I would be driving in their rigs, and there'd be crosses, and there'd be icons and all kinds of stuff, you know, in there. And, of course, in the American ones, it's got to all be sterile. You can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, and so when we go out, before we go out on a mission with the Romanians, we stand in a circle, and we get blessed by the, you know, by the Orthodox guy, and he'd put a little water cross on my head and that type of stuff. And I only had that happen with one other military unit, and that was the 82nd Airborne. And they would get in a circle and say a prayer before we'd go out. And I asked the captain, I said, Captain, how are you able to do this? And he goes, because we're the 82nd.
Yeah.
Right. I'm good with it, you know. So it all varied. The Italians were always late to pick me up, but they always got coffee and pastry.
Well, they had to,
arrivederci.
Yeah,
you know?
They had to get their supplies together. It's like, oh, before we go, we got to make sure brunch is settled.
Yeah, that's so, I mean, funny.
I tell you, half the time over there, I felt like I was a cross between Lawrence of Arabia and a Shaolin monk. Traveling all around with my backpack and sleeping bag.
All you really needed to do was to go around and pretend to have a Scottish accent, and you would be right out of the movies.
Yes, I would. Exactly.
For those who don't know, James Bond.
Right.
What was his? Connery.
Sean Connery
did a movie where he was an Arabian. He was an Arabian. And the entire time, he's got this heavy Scottish accent. Just like, you know, the next movie he did was where he was the captain of a Soviet super secret submarine, but yet he spoke with a Scottish accent.
Red October.
Yeah, Scottish accent.
Well, I did some stuff for the one time I was sitting on my tent.
And no one cared.
Guys walked in with no markings on their uniforms, beard, had the headset on, looked right out of the movies.
Really?
And Americans. And they came in and they said, are you Mr. Rich? And I go, yeah. They said, can you work on some projects for us outside the wire? That's off the base. And I go, yeah, I go out all the time. You know, what can I do for you guys? Let me help you out. And so, make a long story short, I did some stuff for them. So every once in a while, when I'd have to go out to a village to work on a little school or something like that, I'd have to be escorted. And so I'd call the Navy SEALs and I'd say, hey, Senior Chief, can you guys take me out to this place? Are you guys going out in that area? And they go, yeah, okay, we'll get you out there. So they'd get me out there. And one time I was sitting on this roof where they're cleaning out the village. I mean, not hurting anybody, but just make sure there wasn't some bad guys in there to kill Mr. Rich. And I'm sitting on top of the roof, just like right out of one of those movies, flat roof, you know, all mud, brick. And this guy, Navy guy, SEAL, sitting next to me, listening to Creedence Clearwater Revival. And I go, hey, man, on his ear set, you know. And I go, hey, I saw them in concert in 1969. And he looks at me and goes, Mr. Walton, how old are you? At that time I was 60. And he goes, I go, I'm 60. He goes, you're older than my dad. What are you doing here? And I said, well, life doesn't always work out the way you like. So I would advise you to maybe save some more money than I did. And you won't end up in a place like this when you're 60 years old. And wow. They were just up there laughing so hard. And I even said, so if you have a heart attack, and I said, so if I have a heart attack and die, can you put a couple of bullets in me so it makes it look like a better story?
Yeah. You probably have some accidental death insurance that might pay off too. I'm just saying, you know.
Yeah.
You got shot. they make them buy the life insurance before they go into combat.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, whatever, you know, they should just don't make everybody buy that stuff. Just pay them. Get over it. Because it's just underwritten by the government.
It's a government. Well, what more can we say?
Yeah, it's true. So is there anything, I guess we're a little bit over our time, starting to get there. We do about an hour. And it's obviously you can find your book at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or go directly to Mr. Rich's website, which is, hello, anyone?
Oh. Oh yeah, it's
one brick at a time.
Press.com.
onebrickatatimepress.com. And if you want him to sign it, most of our guests have said that if they're in the United States, it's fine. But if you're like in Canada, you're going to have to pay for shipping. So, because we found that out the hard way. My company I work for, Explore Scientific, which helps underwrite the music on this program, which they do. They, you know, whether they know or not, this is a different story. I just use the license. But I am the manager of that department, so I can do what I want. Anyway, so, you know, when shipping stuff to Canada is stupid crazy right now. So you may... Just a piece, you know, something that I've learned. And I guess Vic learned that too, remember?
Oh, yeah. He did talk about that. What was postage was more than the book or something like that?
Postage was $25 to mail a book to Canada.
Yeah.
It was insane. Yeah. And they're doing that to us right now too at Explore Scientific. It's like, what? Why? And then on top of that, you send it to the Amazon Canada. Then Canada's making people pay for shipping again.
Ouch.
I know. The world economics is in an upheaval right now, and it's like, I don't know what's going to happen next.
That's a whole other podcast, man.
I know. But so is there anything, though, that you'd want to leave us with about your adventures?
I would just say, you know, there are some chapters in my book called Cat and Nine Lives about the nine times that I was almost killed. And I used to have the U.S. military guys be around me every once in a while. Said, when you get to one life left, Mr. Rich, let me know. And so we can get the heck away from you. I got stories in there about where I had a grenade dropped in front of me and it bounced across the floor and everybody dove off into underneath the tables and chairs. And I just kind of stood there and looked at it and just went, wow, is this how I'm going out?
is that a grenade?
Yeah. But I think the big go away from it is that I went over there with no agenda. I was just an American. I was like a deer in headlights. All I did was write about, you know, and I'm not a hero or bravery or anything. I tell it out in the book, like I was scared to death. I had one time where I had to run across an area where the snipers were shooting at us. And I asked the Army guys, how do you do this? It was probably about a 20-yard thing I had to run across. And they said, you just run. I said, what? You do this every day? And they go, yeah. And they took off and they ran across. And so I sat there to myself going, I mean, imagine this, you. How do you run across her? How do you get yourself psyched to do this? And I just go, okay, I'm going to count to three. One, two, three. And as I ran, bullets were hitting the gravel and hitting the buildings around me as a sniper shot at me to get across.
When I got over there,
my adrenaline and everything was going so hard and so fast. I was just like, and these guys do it every day and day in and day out. And then they would send the military up in the mountain and try to find the sniper and everything. And a lot of times they were gone by the time it happened. But it just tells the stories of the people, how I was endeared to them, how, you know, we did things together and what I learned from over there about just about life in general and how I came back and how my life changed coming back. I got a burn to actually, you know, go and substitute teach. And I do that 5 days a week now and try to bring a little bit of the world into the school and explain to, like, especially some of the girls, like, hey, all you girls sit in this classroom. If you're in Afghanistan, you couldn't be in school right now. So just going to tell you that different parts of the world, different rules. And so I would say that's what I would leave it at.
Wow. Well, thank you. I could sit here and talk to hours about some of your stories. I mean,
call me back.
We might. I'm enjoying this.
You guys have been the most gracious and easy people to talk to that I've had. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. I just like the stories. It puts, I guess, Afghanistan, I guess, more real, I guess. Yeah. We should appreciate what we have and the education that as a female we're allowed to have. And
yeah, as tough as you think it is, there's some places a lot worse. That's really the lesson that I learned, that I take away from this for men too, because a guy like me, you know, I'd be dead. There'd be no way. They'd put, you know, a big guy like me, just being, even if I was skinny, I'd still be bigger than everybody else. You know, I would be the first person that everybody's have a target on their back. I'd have a target on my back every day. And what could I do? I couldn't do anything.
I had
an Afghan prince over there that was really huge. And he'd laugh about it. He says, the only reason the Taliban don't kill me is because they know they'd have to dig a hole big enough to put me in. That is too much work.
I don't know. For me, I'd probably be sold for someone's cow.
Yeah, that's right.
American woman will exchange for cow.
Don't worry. Don't worry. I'd get a truck of nice Brahmas and bring them over there and exchange it for you.
Oh, thanks.
I'm not sure that's that romantic, but okay.
I know what you're trying to say, though.
Still the people are kind of still the same, though. I mean,
they work hard. You know, they
still love, hate, jealous, all
everything.
That.
Yeah. And, you know, they have a hatred for the Pakistanis. And once you get over there, you understand it, because the farmers will raise potatoes and they have to sell them to the Pakistanis. People over there in the Pakistan in the winter sells them back to them for five times the price because there was no storage units in Afghanistan to store the potatoes. So there's all that kind of stuff that's under the society that you don't really see. And you wonder, well, why is this, you know, hatred? And why is there this stuff going on?
Why it's all desert. There's like nothing can grow there, right?
Oh, no, no. There's called Kalats. They're these huge underground, of course, they all gotten blown up by the Russians, the Americans, a lot of them. But for thousands of years, they had these huge underground canals that they built coming down from the Hindu Kush, which is the tail end of the Himalayas. So they got all this water coming down where they had huge agricultural gardens and everything that they had up there. Up north, there was forests and trees. Unfortunately, the Taliban, and I don't know the reason why, it was scorched the earth. They'd burn down the forests and they'd destroy the farmlands. And
They destroy any old relic.
Right.
They hated all of that stuff. One of the most beautiful carvings out of the side of a mountain or hill or cliff, whatever you want to call it. I can't remember the name of it right now.
Bamiyan. That was the Buddhist.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and they blew it up, got rid of it. Yeah. It's like, why? The one you see in Raiders of the Lost Ark is in Turkey.
Yeah.
And it's not Buddhist. It's Christian, I think. But it was something very similar to the one you saw in the third Raiders of the Lost Ark movie or Indiana Jones.
And there's
movie.
Even a place called Shenhua where I went. I was able to fly there in a helicopter, and there's a pyramid.
Really?
And so they had people there from Oxford at the time trying to figure out who built it and when and how.
Well, you know, there's pyramids all over the world. People tend to build them. Yeah. Probably because they're fairly stable structures and they don't tend to fall down because they're pyramids.
So, well, and Alexander the Great was there, and I assume that he knew what was going on in Egypt. And so, you know, maybe that's how that worked. I don't know.
It could be the Mongs, too. They did some stuff like that.
Yeah, who knows?
It's interesting. We do appreciate you being on the program.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
And we'd be glad to talk to you about more specific stuff. I really like to we need to start thinking about bringing guests back, Andrea.
Okay.
But when we do, we need to get really, really drilled down into certain, you know, specific things we want to talk about.
I'm all for it.
So there may be some stuff there for on the history portion of it. Get him and maybe somebody who's got a PhD in, you know, the history portion of it, because we have history people all around here in Northwest Arkansas, because Fayetteville's University of Arkansas. And, you know, they can compare notes live, because they, you know, people like that never compare notes. The PhDs never ask somebody who went there on their own, because they say, oh, well, I'm a PhD, you can't possibly know. But it's not true.
Nothing takes away from real experience.
Yeah, exactly. The person who's on the ground having to do the real work is the person who knows.
Exactly.
And I think, I don't know, what do you think?
I think so too. I mean, nothing takes away from real experience, because the book and what you learn is not always necessarily how it really went.
Well, it's that way in nursing, isn't it?
Oh my gosh, yes.
I mean, there's tons of stuff that should be not written differently.
Well, the book gives you an idea, but you can't. Not every situation's going to be the same in a book. You have to learn to be able to, you
adapt
know,
and
adapt.
Adapt and overcome. Mm-hmm. What is that from? I can't remember. Anyway, so we've got some people coming. We'll get your ballet dancer. We're going to talk about being in the ballet.
Yes.
What are you, embarrassed?
No, I like the Nutcracker, and it's Nutcracker season.
She's a Nutcracker freak, man. If you want to, anybody listening, if you want to make Andrea the happiest girl in the world, just, you know, email me, and I'll give you a P.O. box to send it to. And send her Nutcrackers.
Yes.
And I don't mean testicle crackers for all you creeps out there. I'm talking about the old school Nutcracker, you know, where his mouth opens and then you go.
I've got one that's a fireman, and I've got one that's a cook, and now I have one that's holding grapes, like a wine.
And you got the Rat King.
The Rat King guy. Yeah, I have his huge collection. I've had,
gosh. Got like 25. Those things.
Yeah, I always like to find the unusual ones, and they're very hard to find. So.
You should get, see if we can find one that's Prince. Not a Prince, but actual Prince, you know, artist formerly known as Prince.
As a Nutcracker?
Yeah, the Nutcracker.
That would definitely be unusual.
He would appreciate that, I think, because he was always about different stuff.
Well, it would be different, that's for sure.
So yeah, just contact me and send her some Nutcrackers. Of course, I'll inspect them first to make sure they aren't actual Nutcrackers. Because I don't want, you know, there's no testicle cracking around here.
Oh, my God, Paul.
So finally, I got her to say it.
If you're out west, we call those Rocky Mountain oysters.
oh, my gosh, who else have we got coming on?
We have Rob coming up. We're going to talk about science and paranormal.
Oh, yeah. He's bringing, there's a guy that says that he can prove Atlantis exists.
Oh, yes.
I want to hear about that.
Yes. We have a lady that's a lawyer that's going to talk about questions with family law.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Family law. We get to that's going to be interesting. See, I have zero knowledge about that because I don't have any kids. And I got divorced from an idiot. And so I didn't have to go to court.
I have some experience because I have kids.
Yeah. And it helps if you're divorcing an idiot.
One would hope.
Why did you speak so badly of her? Just so everybody knows, Andrea didn't know my ex's name for almost 2 months. I just called her ass face. I still call her ass face to this day. They're like, why do you have to be so mean to her? I says, because she's an ass face.
Yes, I didn't know her name until I think your dad said
my mom.
Your mom, and I went, who?
It's like, who is that? It's like, well, that's the way it is with mom, you know. So they'd say, mom, your kids are always like, mom, mom, mom.
Yeah.
And then somebody says, is Vivian there? I don't know who you're talking about.
Yeah. My kids are like, you have a name? I was like, yes, I have a name.
All right. So, Richard, I appreciate you. Mr. Rich. Mr. Rich.
Yes, Mr. Rich.
We appreciate you being on today, and I guess that's what we got. Oh, is that it?
I think that's it.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Andrea and I need your help. If you like our episodes, please give us a 5-star rating and a review. Not sure exactly how that helps us, but it does, and it makes people want to listen. When they see that 5 stars and a good review from you, so go to wherever you're listening to your podcasts, Apple iTunes, Spotify, iHeartMedia, wherever, and hit that 5 stars.